and I'll keep my head down and focus on my life right now."
Zael nodded to him, as if that answer was acceptable. He waved Kaladin forward. Trying to keep his sword form in mind, he'd trained mostly on smoke stance, Kaladin tested forward. He feinted twice, then lunged. Zael's hands became a blur as he pushed the sword to the side with his stretched-out scarf, then twisted his hands around, neatly wrapping the scarf around the sword. That gave him leverage to push the sword farther away as he stepped into Kaladin's lunge and slid his makeshift wrapping along the length of the blade, coming in close. Here, he somehow twisted his cloths around to wrap Kaladin's wrists as well. Kaladin tried a headbutt, but Zael stepped into the move and raised one side of the scarf, letting Kaladin's head go underneath it. With a twirl and a twist, Zael completely tied Kaladin in the scarf. How long was that thing? The exchange left Kaladin with not only his hands tied tightly, but a scarf now holding his arms pinned to his sides, Zael standing behind him. Kaladin couldn't see what Zael did next, but it involved sending a loop of scarf up over Kaladin's head and around his neck. Zael pulled tight, choking off Kaladin's air.
"I think we're losing," Syl said, "to a guy wielding something he found in Adolin's sock drawer."
Kaladin grunted, but a part of him was excited. Frustrating as Zael could be, he was an excellent fighter, and he tested Kaladin in ways he'd never seen before. That was the sort of training he needed in order to beat the Fused. As Zael tried to choke him, Kaladin forced himself to remain calm. He changed Syl into a small dagger. A twist of the wrist cut the scarf, which unraveled the entire trap, leaving Kaladin free to spin and slash with his again-dulled knife. The Ardent blocked the knife with his cloth-wrapped arm. He immediately caught Kaladin's wrist with his other hand, so Kaladin dismissed Syl and summoned her again with his offhand, swinging to make Zael dodge back. Zael snatched a sheet off the fluttering lines, twisting it and wrapping it into a tight length like a cord. Kaladin rubbed his neck.
I think I have seen this style before. You fought like Azure does.
She fights like me, boy.
She's hunting for you, I think.
So Adolin has said. The fool woman will have to get through cultivation's perpendicularity first, so I won't hold my breaths waiting for her to arrive.
He waved for Kaladin to come at him again. Kaladin slipped a throwing knife from his belt, then fell into a sword and knife stance. He waved for Zael to come at him instead. The swordmaster smiled, then threw his sheet at Kaladin. It puffed out, spreading wide as if going for an embrace. By the time Kaladin had cut it down, Zael was gone, ducking out into the rippling cloth forest. Kaladin dismissed Syl, then waved toward the ground. She nodded and dived to look under the sheets, searching for Zael. She pointed in a direction for Kaladin, then dodged between two sheets as a ribbon of light. Kaladin followed carefully. He thought he caught a glimpse of Zael through the sheets, a shadow across the cloth.
"Do you believe?" Kaladin asked as he advanced. "In God or the Almighty or whatever?" "I don't have to believe," the voice drifted back. "I know gods exist. I simply hate them."
Kaladin dodged between a pair of sheets. In that moment, sheets began ripping free of the lines. They sprang for Kaladin, six at once, and he swore he could see the outlines of faces and figures in them. He summoned Syl and, keeping his head, ignored the unnerving sight and found Zael. Kaladin lunged. Zael, moving with almost supernatural poise, raised two fingers and pressed them to the moving blade, turning the point aside exactly enough that it missed. The wind swirled around Kaladin as he stepped into the rippling sheets. They flowed against him, insubstantial, but then entangled his legs. He tripped with a curse, falling to the hard stone. A second later, Zael had Kaladin's own knife in hand pressed to his forehead. Kaladin felt the point right among his scars.
"You cheated," Kaladin said. "You're doing something with those sheets and that cloth." "I couldn't cheat," Zael said. "This wasn't about winning or losing, boy. It was for me to see how you fought. I can tell more about a man when the odds are against him."
Zael stood and dropped the knife with a clang. Kaladin recovered it, sitting up and glanced at the fallen sheets. They lay on the ground, normal cloths, occasionally shifting in the breeze. In fact, another man might have dismissed their motions as a trick of the wind. But Kaladin knew the wind. That had not been the wind.
"You can't join the Ardents," Zael said to him, kneeling and touching one of the cloths with his finger, then lifting it up and pinning it onto the drying line.
He did the same for the others, each in turn.
"Why can't I?" Kaladin asked.
He wasn't certain Zael had the authority to forbid him, but he also wasn't certain he wanted to take this path if Zael, the one Ardent he felt true respect for, was opposed.
"Do you make everyone who wants to retire to the Ardentia fight you for the privilege?"
"It wasn't a fight about winning or losing," Zael said. "You're not unwelcome because you lost. You're unwelcome because you don't belong with us."
He whipped a sheet in the air, then pinned it in place.
"You love the fight, Kaladin. Not with the thrill that Dalinar once felt, or even with the anticipation of a dandy going to a duel. You love it because it's part of you. It's your mistress, your passion, your lifeblood. You'd find the daily training unsatisfying. You'd thirst for something more. You'd eventually turn and leave, and that would put you in a worse position than if you'd never started."
He tossed his scarf at Kaladin's feet, though it must have been a different scarf, for the one he'd started with had been bright red and this one was dull gray.
"Return when you hate the fight," Zael said. "Truly hate it."
He walked off between the sheets. Kaladin picked up the fallen scarf, then glanced at Syl, who descended through the air near him on an invisible set of steps. She shrugged. Kaladin gripped the cloth, then strode around the sheets. The swordmaster had moved to sit at the rim of the plateau, legs over the edge, staring out across the nearby mountain range. Kaladin dropped the scarf on a pile of others, each of which was now gray.
"What are you?" Kaladin asked. "Are you like Wit?"
There had always been something about Zael, something too knowing, something distinct, set apart, different from the others.
"No," Zael said. "I don't think there's anyone else quite like Hoid. I knew him by the name Dust when I was younger. I think he must have 1,000 different names among 1,000 different peoples."
"And you?"
Kaladin settled down on the stone beside Zael. "How many names do you have?"
"A few," Zael said. "More than I normally share."
He leaned forward, elbows on thighs. Wind blew at the hem of his robe, dangling over a drop of thousands of feet.
"You want to know what I am? Well, I'm a lot of things. Tired, mostly. But I'm also a Type 2 invested entity. I used to call myself a Type 1, but I had to throw the whole scale out once I learned more. That's the trouble with science. It's never done. Always upending itself, ruining perfect systems for the little inconvenience of them being wrong."
Kaladin swallowed. "I don't know what any of that meant, but thanks for replying. Wit never gives me answers, at least not straight ones."
"That's because Wit is an asshole," Zael said.
He fished in his robe's pocket and pulled something out, a small stone in the shape of a curling shell.
"Ever seen one of these?"
"Soulcast?"
Kaladin asked, taking the small shell. It was surprisingly heavy. He turned it around, admiring the way it curled.
"Similar. That's a creature that died long, long ago. It settled into the mud and slowly, over thousands upon thousands of years, minerals infused its body, replacing it axon by axon with stone. Eventually, the entire thing was transformed."
"So, natural soul casting? Over time?"
A long time. A mind-numbingly long time. The place I come from, it didn't have any of these. It's too new. Your world might have some hidden deep, but I doubt it. That stone you hold is old. Older than wit, or your heralds, or the gods themselves.
Kaladin held it up, then, out of habit, used a few drops of water from his canteen to reveal its hidden colors and shades.
My soul, Zael said, is like that fossil. Every part of my soul has been replaced with something new, though it happened in a flash for me. The soul I have now resembles the one I was born with, but it's something else entirely.
I don't understand.
I'm not surprised, Zael thought for a moment. Imagine it this way. You know how you can make an imprint in Krem, then let it dry and fill the imprint with wax to create a copy of your original object? Well, that happened to my soul. When I died, I was drenched in power. So when my soul escaped, it left a duplicate, a kind of fossil of a soul.
Kaladin hesitated. You died? Zael nodded.
Happened to your friend, too, up in the prison. The one with that sword.
Zeth, not my friend.
The heralds, too, Zael said. When they died, they left an imprint behind. Power that remembered being them. You see, the power wants to be alive.
He gestured with his chin towards Syl, flying down beneath them as a ribbon of light.
She's what I now call a Type 1 invested entity. I decided that had to be the proper way to refer to them. Power that came alive on its own.
You can see her, Kaladin said.
See? No. Sense?
Zael shrugged.
Cut off a bit of divinity and leave it alone. Eventually it comes alive, and if you let a man die with too invested a soul, or invest him right as he's dying, he'll leave behind a shadow you can nail back onto a body. His own, if you're feeling charitable. Once done, you have this.
Zael waved to himself.
Type 2 invested entity. Dead man walking.
What a strange conversation. Kaladin frowned, trying to figure out why Zael was telling him this. I suppose I did ask, so wait. Maybe there was another reason. The fused? Kaladin asked. That's what they are?
Yeah, he said. Most of us stop aging when it happens, gaining a kind of immortality.
Is there a way to kill something like you? Permanently?
Lots of ways. For the weaker ones, just kill the body again. Make sure no one invests the soul with more strength, and they'll slip away in a few minutes. For stronger ones, well, you might be able to starve them. A lot of Type 2s feed on power. Keeps them going. These enemies of yours, though, I think they're too strong for that. They've lasted thousands of years already and seem connected to Odium to feed directly on his power. You'll have to find a way to disrupt their souls. You can't just rip them apart. You need a weapon so strong it unravels the soul.
He squinted, looking off into the distance.
I know through sorry experience those kinds of weapons are very dangerous to make and never seem to work right.
There's another way, Kaladin said. We could convince the Fuse to stop fighting. Instead of killing them, we could find a way to live with them.
Grand ideals, Zael said. Optimism. Yeah, you'd make a terrible swordmaster. Be wary of those fused, kid. The longer one of us exists, the more like a spren we become. consumed by a singular purpose, our minds bound and chained by our intent. We're Spren masquerading as men. That's why she takes her memories. She knows we aren't the actual people who died, but something else given a corpse to inhabit.
She? Kaladin asked. Zael didn't respond, though when Kaladin handed back the stone shell, Zael took it. As Kaladin hiked off, the swordmaster cradled it to his chest, staring out toward the endless horizon.
16. An Unknown Song. My final point of the evening is a discussion of fused weapons. The fused use a variety of fabrial devices to fight radiance. It is obvious from how quickly they've fabricated and employed these countermeasures that they have used these in the past. Lecture on Fabrial Mechanics, presented by Navani Kolin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesavan, 1175. Navani held up the dark sphere, closing one eye to inspect it closely. It was different from void light. She held up a void light sphere for comparison, a diamond infused with the strange light gathered during the Everstorm. They still didn't know how the enemy infused spheres with void light. All they owned were stolen from the Singers. Fortunately, void light leaked far more slowly than stormlight did. She probably had a few more days before this one went done. The void light sphere had a strange glow to it, a distinctive purple on black, which Rushu described as a hyperviolet, a color she claimed existed in theory, though Navani didn't know how a color could be theoretical. Regardless, this was a purple on black, coexisting in such a way that both shades simultaneously occupied the same space. The strange sphere that Zeth had provided seemed exactly the same at first glance. Purple upon black, an impossible color. Like the ordinary void light sphere, its blackness expanded, making the surrounding air dim. But there was an added effect with this sphere, one she hadn't noticed right away. It warped the air around it. Looking at the sphere for too long was a distinctively disorienting sensation. It evoked a wrongness that she couldn't define. Gavilar had possessed void light spheres. She remembered seeing them. And that fact was befuddling enough. How had her husband obtained void light years before the arrival of the Everstorm? But this other black sphere, what on Roshar was it? Assassin, Navani said. Look at me. Zeth, the assassin in white, looked up from within his cell. 16 days had passed since Navani and Dalinar had returned from testing the fourth bridge in battle. 16 days spent catching up on mundane work in the tower, like overseeing planned expansions of the market and dealing with sanitation problems. Only now did she have a large chunk of time to dedicate to Voidlight and the nature of the tower. The strange individual who had contacted her via Spanreed had not spoken to her again. Navani had decided not to worry about them. She didn't even know if they were sane. She had plenty else to worry about, such as the man sitting in the prison cell in front of her. Zeth cradled his strange shard blade in his lap, the one that leaked black smoke when unsheathed. When challenged about letting the prisoner remain armed, Dalinar had replied, "I believe the safest place to keep the thing is in his possession." Navani questioned that wisdom. In her opinion, they should sink the strange blade in the ocean, like they'd done with the gemstone that contained the thrill. Zeth did not seem stable enough to be trusted with a shard, particularly not one so dangerous as this. In fact, She wished the assassin had been executed as he deserved. Dalinar disagreed, and so they decided together to leave Zeth alive. Today, the Shin Man sat on the floor of his stone cell, eyes closed, wearing white clothing by his own request. He had been given what few amenities he asked for: a razor for shaving, a single blanket, a chance to bathe each day. And light. A great deal of light. Dozens of spheres to illuminate his small stone cell and banish all traces of shadow. They'd fitted the front of the room with bars, though those wouldn't keep the assassin contained should he decide to escape. That shard blade could reduce objects to smoke simply by nicking them. "Tell me again," Navani said to him, "of the night you killed my husband." "I was instructed by the Parshendi to execute him," Zeth said softly. "Were you curious why they'd kill a man on the very night they were signing a peace treaty with him?" "I thought I was truthless," Zeth said. "That status required that I do as my master commanded, without question." His voice bore only the faintest hint of an accent. "Your master is now Dalinar." "Yes, I have found a better way. Throughout my truthless existence, I followed the way of the Oathstone. I would obey anyone who held that stone. Now, I have realized I was never truthless. I have sworn to an ideal instead. The Blackthorn. Whatever he wishes, I will make reality." "What if Dalinar dies?" "I will seek another ideal, I suppose. I had not considered it." "How could you not think of that?" "I simply did not." "Storms, this is dangerous," Navani thought. Dalinar could speak of redemption and mending broken spirits, but this creature was a fire burning unchecked, ready to escape the hearth and consume any fuel it could find. Zeth had murdered kings and high princes, over a dozen rulers, all across Roshar. Yes, much of that blame fell on Taravangian, but Zeth was the tool employed to cause such destruction. "You didn't finish your story," Navani said. "The night you killed Gavilar. Tell me again what happened. The part with this sphere." "We fell," Zeth whispered, opening his eyes. "Gavilar was injured by the impact, his body fatally broken. In that moment, he treated me not as an enemy, but as the last living man he would ever see. He made a request, a holy request, the last words of the dying. He spoke a few names, which I do not remember, asking if those men had sent me. When I assured him they had not, he was relieved. I think he feared the sphere falling into their hands, so he gave it to me. He trusted his own murderer more than those who surrounded him." "Including me," Navani thought. Storms. She'd assumed she was over her anger and frustration with Gavilar. But there it was, twisting around itself in the pit of her stomach, causing anger spren to rise beneath her feet. "He told me a message to give his brother," Zeth continued, his eyes flickering toward the pooling anger spren. "I wrote the words, as it was the best I could do to fulfill that dying request. I took the sphere and hid it, until you asked me if I'd found anything on his body, whereupon I recovered it." This he'd done only a month ago, because Navani had thought to ask the question. Otherwise, he would simply have gone on without saying a word of this sphere, as if his mind were too childlike or stressed to realize he should speak up. Navani shivered. She was in favor of comforting the sick of mind, once they were carefully contained, and things like evil-talking shard blades were removed from their possession. She had a list of facts she'd collected from him about that blade, and she thought maybe it was an honor blade that had been corrupted somehow. It had been given to Zeth by one of the heralds, after all. She found it difficult to study, however, because being around Zeth made her feel sick. At least the sword's spren had stopped speaking into the minds of those who passed by the prison. It had taken 3 demands from Dalinar to get Zeth to finally restrain the thing. "You're certain this is the exact sphere he gave you?" Navani said.
"It is."
"And he said nothing about it to you?"
"I have answered this question."
"And you will answer it again, until I'm certain you haven't forgotten any more details." Zeth sighed softly.
"He did not speak of the sphere. He was dying. He could barely force out his last words. I am not certain they are prophetic, as the voices of the dying sometimes are in my land. I followed them anyway."
She turned to go. She had more questions, but she had to budget her time with the assassin. Each moment near him made her feel physically ill. Even now her stomach was beginning to churn, and she feared losing her breakfast.
"Do you hate me?" Zeth asked from behind.
Calm, almost emotionless. Too calm, too emotionless, for words spoken to a widow at his hand.
"Yes," Navani said.
"Good," Zeth said, the word echoing in the small chamber.
"Good. Thank you."
Shivering and nauseous, Navani fled his presence. Less than an hour later, she stepped out onto the cloud walk, a garden balcony set at the base of the 8th tier of the tower. Urethiru was nearly 200 floors tall, 10 tiers of 18 floors each, and so the 8th tier was near the top, at a dizzying height. Most of the tower was built up against the mountains, with chunks of the structure embedded fully into the stone. It was only here, near the top, that the tower fully peaked up above the surrounding stone. The cloud walk rounded almost the entire perimeter of the tier, an open stone pathway with a sure railing on one side. It sported some of the best views Urethiru had to offer. Navani had often come here during their early months in the tower, but news of the spectacular views had spread. When once she'd been able to walk the entire cloud walk without encountering another soul, today she was met by the sight of tens of people strolling up here. She forced herself to see it as a victory, not an encroachment. Part of their vision for this tower was a city where the different peoples of Roshar intermixed. With the Oath Gates providing direct access to cities around the continent, Urethiru could grow to be cosmopolitan in ways that Kolinar could never have dreamed. As she walked, she saw not only the uniforms of 7 different princedoms, but people wearing the patterns of 3 different Makabaki local governments, Thalen merchants, Emuli soldiers, and Natan tradesmen were represented. There were even a few Amians, remnants of the humans who had escaped Amia, the men with their beards bound in cords. Most of the world was embroiled in war, but Urethiru stood apart, a place of calm serenity above the storms. Soldiers came here when rotated off active duty. Tradesmen brought their wares, enduring wartime tariffs to avoid the cost of trying to deliver goods across battle lines. Scholars came to let their minds spark against those working to solve the problems of a new era. Urethiru was truly something great. She wished Elokar had lived to see how wonderful it was becoming. Best she could do was see that his son grew up to appreciate it. So, Navani opened her arms as she reached the meeting point. The nursemaid set Gavinor down, and he rushed over, jumping into Navani's embrace. She hung to him tightly, appreciating the progress they'd made. When Gavinor had finally been recovered, he'd been so frightened and timid he had cringed when Navani tried to hug him. That trauma, now a year past, was finally fading from the boy. He was often solemn, too solemn for a boy of 5, but at least with her he'd learned to laugh again. "Gram," he said. "Gram, I rode a horse." "All on your own?" she asked, lifting him. "Adolin helped me," he said, "but it was a big horse, and I wasn't scared, even when it started walking. Look, look." He pointed, and she lifted him up as they peered toward the fields far below. It was too far to make out details, but that didn't stop little Gav from explaining to her, at length, the different colors of horses he'd seen. She gave him an encouraging smile. His excitement was not only infectious, it was relieving. During his first few months in the tower, he'd hardly spoken. Now his willingness to do more than barely go near the horses, which fascinated him but also terrified him, was a huge improvement. She held Gav, warm despite the chill air, as he talked. The child was still far too small for his age, and the doctors weren't certain if something strange had been done to him during his time in Kolinor. Navani was furious at Aes Sedain for all that had happened there, but equally furious at herself. How much was Navani to blame for leaving the woman alone to invite in one of the unmade? "You couldn't have known," Navani told herself. "You can't be to blame for everything." She tried to overcome those feelings, and the equally irrational ones that whispered she shared blame for Elokar's death. If she'd stopped him from going on that fool's mission... No. No, she would hold Gav. She would hurt, but she would move forward. She pointedly thought on her wonderful moments holding Elokar as a little boy, not fixating on the idea of that little boy dying to a traitor's spear. "Gram," Gav asked, as they looked out over the mountains, "I want Grandpa to teach me the sword." "Oh, I'm certain he can get to that eventually," Navani said, then pointed. "See that cloud? It's so huge." "Other boys my age learn the sword," Gav said, his voice growing softer. "Don't they?" "They did. In Alethkar, families, particularly light-eyed ones, would go to war together. The Azish thought it unnatural, but to the Alethi it was the way of things. Children as young as 10 would learn to serve as officers' aides, and boys would often be given a training sword as soon as they could walk. "You don't need to worry about that," Navani said to him. "If I have a sword," Gav said, "nobody will be able to hurt me. I'll be able to find the man who killed my father, and I could kill him." Navani felt a chill unrelated to the cold air. On one hand, it was a very Alethi thing to say. It broke her heart regardless. She hugged Gav tight. "Don't worry about it." "Will you talk to Grandpa, please?" she sighed. "I'll ask him." Gav nodded, smiling. Her time with him was short, unfortunately. She had a meeting with Dalinar and Yasna in under an hour, and she needed to check with some scientists up here on the Cloud Walk first. So she eventually turned Gav back over to the nursemaid. Then she wiped her eyes, feeling silly at crying over something so trivial, and hurried on her way. It was just that Elokar had been learning so much. During these last years, she'd seen him growing into something great, a better man than Gavilar, worthy of the kingship. A mother should never have to grieve for her children, should never have to think of her poor little boy lying alone and dead on the floor of an abandoned palace. She forced herself forward, nodding to those soldiers who chose to bow, or, oddly, salute her, hands to shoulders, with the knuckles out. Soldiers these days. She supposed with some of their commanders learning to read, and some of their sisters joining the Radiance, life could get confusing. She eventually reached the research station set up at the far end of the cloud walk. The head scientist in charge of atmospheric measurements was an Ardent with a particularly long neck. With his bald head and the sagging skin under his chin, Brother Benna resembled nothing so much as an eel who had put on robes and grown a pair of arms through sheer determination. But he was a happy fellow, and he spryly bounced over to her with his notebooks. "Brightness," he said, pointedly ignoring Elthabar the Storm Warden, who was taking his own measurements from the nearby instruments. "Look here, look here." Benna pointed out the historical barometer readings he'd recorded in his notebook. "Here, here," he said, tapping the barometer, which was set up on a scientific table with thermometers, some plants, a sundial, and a small astrolabe. That was in addition to the various astrological nonsenses the Storm Wardens had erected. "It rises," Benna said, almost breathless. "Ahead of a storm." "Wait. The barometer rises ahead of a storm?" "Yes." "That's backward, isn't it?" "Yes, indeed, indeed. And see? The temperature readings before a storm rise slightly, too. You wondered how much colder it was up here on the cloud walk than it was below near the fields. Brightness? It's warmer." She frowned, then glanced toward the promenading people. No sign of their breath in front of their faces. It felt colder up here. She herself had noted that. But could that be because she expected it to be? Besides, she always left the interior of the tower to come out. It was impossible not to compare it to the warmth inside, instead of the temperature below. "How cold is it right now?" she asked. "Down below?" "I asked, via Spanreed. Measurements are conclusive. At least 5 degrees colder on the plateau."
5 degrees? Storms.
"Heat in front of a storm, and a rise in pressure," Navani said. "It defies our understanding. But has anyone done readings like this from such an elevation? Perhaps what is natural near sea level is inverted up here."
"Yes, yes," the Ardent said. "I could perhaps see that. But look at these books. They contradict such a theory. Measurements taken from various horn-eater trading expeditions. Let me find them."
He started digging through papers, though she didn't need them. She had a suspicion of what was happening. Why would pressure and temperature rise before a storm? Because the structure was bracing itself. The tower could adapt to the storms. More proof. The data was growing as mountainous as these peaks. The tower could regulate temperature, pressure, humidity. If Urethiru could be made fully functional, life up here would improve dramatically. But how to fix it, when the Spren that had lived here was supposedly dead? She was so absorbed by the problem, she nearly missed the bowing. Her subconscious initially assumed the bows were for her, but too many people were involved, and they were going too low. She turned to find Dalinar passing by, Taravangian at his side. People backed out of the way before the two kings, and Navani felt like a fool. She'd known they were meeting this afternoon, and this was one of their favorite places to promenade. Others found it encouraging to see the two kings together, but Navani did not miss the gap between them. She knew things others did not. For instance, Dalinar no longer met his former friend beside the hearth to chat for hours, and Taravangian no longer attended private meetings of Dalinar's inner circle. They hadn't been able, nor were they yet willing, to excise Taravangian from the coalition of monarchs. His crimes, though terrible, were no more bloody than Dalinar's own. The fact that Taravangian had sent Zeth against the Azish emperors had certainly strained relations and increased tensions within the coalition. But for now, they all agreed that the servants of Odium were a far more pressing enemy. Taravangian, however, would never again be a man to trust. At least Dalinar's terrible actions had been part of an official act of war. Though, she had to admit, some moral high ground had been lost upon the early circulations of Dalinar's memoir. The Kolin troops, once so proud they'd bordered on imperious, walked with slightly slumped shoulders, their heads no longer held quite as high. Everyone had known about the atrocities of the Kolin Unification War. They'd heard of the Blackthorn's fearsome reputation, and of cities burned and pillaged. So long as Dalinar had been willing to pretend his actions had been noble, the kingdom could pretend along with him. Now the Alethi had to face the truth, long tucked away behind justifications and political spin. No army, no matter how clean its reputation, walked away from war untainted. And no leader, no matter how noble, could help but sink into the creme when he stepped into the game of conquest. She spent a little longer going over readings with Benna, then checked on the royal astronomers, who were erecting a new set of telescopes made with the highest quality lenses out of Thalina. They were certain they'd be able to get some spectacular views from up here once the telescopes were calibrated. Navani asked the women a few questions as they worked, but left when she felt she was becoming a bother. A true patron of the sciences knew when she was hindering instead of helping. As she turned to leave, however, Navani paused, then dug Zeth's strange voidlight sphere from her pocket. Talna, she asked one of the engineers, you were a jeweler, weren't you, before taking up lens work?
Still am, some seasons, the short woman replied. I put in a few hours at the mint last week, checking sphere weights.
What do you think of this? Navani said, holding up the sphere. Talna tucked a strand of hair behind her ear and took the sphere, holding it up in a gloved hand.
What is this? Void light?
She searched in her jacket pocket and pulled out a jeweler's loop, then pressed it to her eye.
We're not sure, Navani said.
Stormfather, the woman said. That's a nice diamond. Hey, Nem, have a look.
Another of the engineers came over and accepted the sphere and loop, whistling softly.
I have a higher magnification in my bag over there, she said, waving,
and an assistant engineer helpfully fetched a larger magnifying device, one you could look through with both eyes.
What is it? Navani said. What do you see?
Practically flawless, Nem said, clamping the sphere in some small grips. This wasn't grown as a gem heart, I can tell you that. The structure would never align so perfectly. This sphere is worth thousands brightness. It will probably hold stormlight for months without leaking any out. Maybe years. Longer for void light.
It was left in a cave for over 6 years, Navani said, and was glowing, or whatever you call that blackness, the same when it was retrieved.
Quite strange indeed, Talna said. What an odd sphere brightness. That must be void light, but it feels wrong. I mean, it's black violet like others I've seen, but...
The air warps around it, Navani said.
Yeah, Talna said. That's it. How strange. Can we keep it to study it?
Navani hesitated. She'd planned to do her own tests on the sphere, but she had to see to the needs of the tower and work on new iterations of her flying machine. To be honest,
She'd been planning to run tests on this sphere ever since she'd received it, but there was never enough time.
Yes, please do, Navani said. Run some standard stormlight measuring tests for luminosity and the like. Then see if you can move the light to other gemstones. If you can, try to use it to power various fabrials.
Void light doesn't work on fabrials, Nem said, frowning. But you're right. Maybe this isn't void light. It certainly does look strange.
Navani made them promise to keep the sphere hidden and to reveal the results of their tests only to her. She gave them leave to requisition several real void light spheres captured in battle to use in comparisons. Then she left the strange sphere with them, feeling agitated. Not because she didn't trust the two. They dealt with extremely expensive and delicate equipment and had proven reliable. But the peace of Navani hoping to study this sphere herself was disappointed. Unfortunately, this was work for scholars, not her. She left it in their capable hands and moved on. She was therefore the first to arrive in the small windowless chamber near the top of the tower, where Jasnah and Dalinar held their private meetings. These top floors were small enough to control entirely, with guard posts to regulate access. Too often down below, rooms and hallways felt oppressive, as if something was watching. Openings in walls, running as air ducts through the rooms, often led in bizarre patterns, barely mapped by the children they'd sent to crawl through them. You could never be completely certain that someone wasn't listening at an opening nearby, eavesdropping on private conversations. Up here, though, the floors often had a dozen or fewer rooms, all carefully mapped and tested for acoustics. Most had windows, which made them feel inviting. She felt lighter even in a windowless stone chamber like this one, so long as her mind knew open sky was right beyond the wall. As she waited, Navani puttered in her notebooks, theorizing about Gavilar's dark sphere. She flipped to a testimonial she'd transcribed from Relaine, the listener member of Bridge 4. He swore that Gavilar had given his general, Eshenai, a void light sphere years before the coming of the Everstorm. When Navani showed him this second sphere, his reaction had been curious.
"I don't know what that is, Brightness," he'd said. "But it feels painful. Void light is dangerously inviting. Like if I touched it, my body would drink it in eagerly. That thing is different. It has a song I've never heard, and it vibrates wrong against my soul."
She flipped to another page and wrote some thoughts. What would happen if they tried to grow plants by the dark light of this sphere? Dared she let a radiant try to suck out its strange energy? She was writing along these lines when Adolin and Shallan arrived with the mink. They'd periodically been entertaining him these last few weeks, showing him around the tower, dividing out space for his troops once they arrived with the fourth bridge in the next few days. The short Herdazian didn't wear a uniform, merely some common trousers and a buttoned shirt cut after simple Herdazian styles, with suspenders and a loose coat. How odd. Didn't he know he wasn't a refugee any longer?
"Think you could teach me?" Shallan was saying, red hair and no hat. "I really want to know how you got out of those cuffs."
"There's an art to it," the general said. "It's more than practice. It's about instinct. Each set of confines is a puzzle to be solved. And your reward? Going where you shouldn't. Being what you shouldn't. Brightness. It is not a particularly seemly hobby for a well-connected young woman."
"Trust me," she said. "I am anything but well-connected. I keep finding pieces of myself lying around, forgotten."
She led the mink over to the other door to point out the guard post beyond. Adolin gave Navani a hug, then took the seat next to her.
"She's fascinated by him," he whispered to Navani. "I should have guessed she would be." "What's that clothing he's wearing?" Navani whispered.
I know. Adolin grimaced. "I offered him my tailor's. Said we'd get him a Herdazian uniform. He said there is no Herdaz anymore. Besides, a man in uniform can't go the places I like to go. I don't know what to make of him."
Across the small room, the mink glanced at one of the stone air vents, nodding as Shallan explained the room's security.
"He's plotting how to sneak away," Adolin said with a sigh, putting his feet up on the table. "He lost us 5 times today. I can't decide if he's paranoid, crazy, or merely has a cruel sense of humor." He leaned toward Navani. "I suspect it wouldn't have been that bad if Shallan hadn't been so impressed the first time. He does like to show off."
Navani eyed Adolin's new gold-trimmed boots. They were the 3rd pair she'd seen him wearing this week.
Dalinar arrived, depositing 2 bodyguards outside the front door. He kept trying to get Navani to accept some guards of her own, and she always agreed, when she had equipment she needed carried. And honestly, Dalinar couldn't complain. How often had he ditched his own guards? The room had been set up with a few chairs and only 1 small table, the one Adolin had his boots on. That boy. He never leaned back in his chair or put his feet up when he was wearing ordinary shoes. Dalinar passed by, wrapping the boots with his knuckles.
"Decorum," he said. "Discipline. Dedication."
"Detail. Duel. Dessert." Adolin glanced at his father. "Oh, sorry. I thought we were saying random words that started with the same sound."
Dalinar glowered at Shallan.
"What?" she said.
"He was never like this before you arrived," Dalinar said.
"Stormfather, help us," Shallan said lightly, sitting beside her husband and laying a protective hand upon his knee. "A Colin has learned to relax once in a while. Surely the moons will stop orbiting and the sun will come crashing down."
Neither Shallan nor Dalinar would admit to squabbling over Adolin. Indeed, Navani suspected Dalinar would insist he approved of the marriage. But he'd also never needed to give up one of his children to the influence of an outsider. Navani felt Dalinar blamed Shallan too much for the changes in the boy. Shallan wasn't pushing him to be something he was not. More, he finally felt free enough to explore an identity that wasn't tied to being the Blackthorn's son. Adolin was High Prince now. He should have the opportunity to define what that meant for him. For his part, Adolin just laughed.
"Shallan, you're really complaining that someone is too intense? You? Even your jokes sometimes feel like a competition."
She glanced to him, then, instead of being provoked, seemed to relax. Adolin had that effect on people.
"Of course they are," she said. "My life is a constant struggle against boredom. If I relax my guard, you'll find me knitting or something dreadful like that."
The mink watched the exchange with a smile.
"Ah, reminds me of my own son and his wife."
"I should hope," Dalinar said. "They are a little less frivolous."
"They're dead. In the war,"
the mink said softly.
"I'm sorry," Dalinar said. "The Everstorm and Odium have cost us all much."
"Not that war, Blackthorn."
The mink gave him a look laden with implication. Then he turned toward Navani.
"The High Prince mentioned maps for me to inspect. He said they'd be waiting, but I don't see any in here, nor a table of proper size to roll them out upon. Should we fetch them? I'm very curious to see your troop layouts against the Voidbringers.
We don't use the term Voidbringers anymore, Dalinar said. It has proven to be imprecise. We call our enemies the Singers. As for the map, it's right here.
He looked to Shallan, who nodded, taking in a breath of stormlight from the spheres in her satchel.
Navani hurried to prepare her notebook. Together, Shallan and Dalinar summoned the map.
17. A Proposal. The simplest fused weapon against us isn't truly a fabril, but instead a metal that is extremely light and can withstand the blows of a shard blade. This metal resists being soulcast as well. It interferes with a great number of radiant powers. Fortunately, the fused seem unable to create it in great quantities, for they equip only themselves, and not their average soldiers, with these wonders. Lecture on Fabrial Mechanics presented by Navani Kolin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesavan, 1175. Navani had seen Shallan and Dalinar summon the map dozens of times, but, as with Dalinar's ability to recharge spheres, she felt there was more to be learned by careful examination. First, Shallan breathed out, and her stormlight expanded outward in a disk. Dalinar breathed out his own light, which melded with Shallan's, spiraling across the surface like a whirlpool. The two planes of luminescent smoke spun outward, flat and round, filling the room at about waist height. Somehow, Shallan's light weaving mixed with Dalinar's connection to the land to create this magnificent representation of Roshar. The Stormfather implied that Dalinar, as a bondsmith, could do similar marvels with other orders, but so far their experiments had been fruitless. The map's sudden appearance caused the mink to scramble away. He was at the door in a fraction of a second, standing with it cracked, ready to flee. He was a paranoid type, wasn't he? Navani focused on the map, her pen poised. Could she sense anything? Perhaps Shadesmar? No. Something else. The sensation of flight, soaring above a tempestuous ocean, free, dreamlike. The light seemed to become solid, snapping into the shape of a map of the continent, as if seen from high above. Fully rendered in color, it showed mountains and valleys in exacting topographical detail, all to scale. The mink's eyes went wide, and Ospren burst above him like a ring of smoke. Navani understood that emotion. Watching the radiance work was like experiencing the intensity of the sun or the majesty of a mountain. Yes, it was becoming commonplace to her, but she doubted it would ever become common. The mink shut the door with a click, then stepped over to reach a hand into the illusion. A small portion of it wavered and swirled into misty stormlight. He cocked his head, then walked into the center of the map, which distorted around him, then snapped back into focus after he stilled.
"By Kallak's mighty breath,"
the mink said, leaning over to inspect a miniature mountain.
"This is incredible."
"The combined powers of a light weaver and a bondsmith," Dalinar said. "It is not a picture of the world as it exists at this moment, unfortunately. We update the map every few days when the high storm blows through. This limits our ability to count enemy troop numbers, since they tend to move inside for the storm."
"The map gets that detailed?" the mink asked. "You can see individuals?"
Dalinar waved, and a portion of the map expanded. The far perimeters vanished, as this specific section became more and more detailed, focusing in on Azimir. The Azish capital expanded from a dot to a full-sized city, then stopped
at its best magnification, a scale where buildings were the size of spheres and people were specks. Dalinar zoomed the map back out to full size and glanced to Shallan. She nodded, and numbers began to hover in the air above portions of the map, swirling and made from stormlight, marked by glyphs that men could read.
"These are our best estimates of troop numbers," Dalinar said. "Singer counts in gold, our troop counts, which of course are more accurate, in the color of the appropriate army. Divided by glyph, you'll find foot soldiers, heavy infantry, archers, and what few cavalry we can likely field in each area."
The Mink walked through the map, and Navani tracked him with her eyes, more interested in him than the numbers. The Mink took his time, inspecting each region of Roshar and its troop concentrations. As he was thus surveying, the door opened. Navani's daughter, Her Majesty Queen Yasna Kolin of Alethkar, had arrived. She had four guards. Yasna never went about alone, though she was more capable with her powers than any other Radiant. She deposited the guards outside the door and entered with only one man shadowing her, the Queen's Wit, tall and lanky, with jet black hair and an angular face. It was the same Wit who had served Elokar, so Navani had known this man for a few years. Yet he was different now. Navani often noted him and Yasna whispering in conspiratorial tones during meetings. He treated Navani and, well, everyone, as if he knew them intimately. There was a mystery about this Wit that Navani had never noticed during Elokar's reign. Perhaps he molded himself to the monarch he served. He stayed in step right behind Yasna, silvery sheathed sword on his hip, his lips drawn ever so slightly to a smile. The type that made you think he must be considering a joke about you that no one had the decency to say to your face. "I see we have our map," Yasna said. "And our new general."
"Indeed," said the Mink, who was reading the troop numbers over Aesir.
"Thoughts?" Yasna asked, ever practical. The Mink continued his inspection. Navani tried to guess what conclusions he'd draw. The war was happening on two main fronts. In Makabak, the region encompassing Aesir and the many small kingdoms surrounding it, coalition forces continued to battle the Singers over a specific region, the kingdom of Emul. The drawn-out conflicts were only the newest in a series of wars that had left the kingdom, once proud, war-torn and broken. So far, neither side had an advantage. Aesish armies, with the help of Alethi strategists, had recaptured some ground in northern Emul. However, they didn't dare advance too far, as the wild card of the region might come into play if they reached the south. Nestled behind Odium's forces was the army of Tezim, the god priest, a man they now knew was Ishar, the ancient herald gone mad. Tezim had been quiet lately, unfortunately. Dalinar had hoped he would rage against the rear lines of the Singers, forcing them to fight pressed between two armies. As it stood, the brutal fighting in Emul continued at a standstill. The coalition could easily resupply its lines through the Oathgates to the north and Thalen shipping to the south. The enemy had vast numbers of former Parshmen and access to larger numbers of irregulars, fused in this case. The Mink took in the details of this battlefront, studying the shipping and navy numbers with interest.
"You control the entire southern depths?" he asked.
"The enemy has a navy, stolen from Thalena," Yasna said. "We have only the ships that we've managed to build since then, and the ones that escaped that fate. So our continued dominance is not assured. But following a singular victory by Fenn's navy 4 months ago, the enemy retreated their ships into Irialli waters to the far northwest.
Currently, they seem content to control the northern seas, while we control the south. The mink nodded and moved to the east, inspecting the second of the war's two battlefronts, the line between Alethkar and Yakaved. Here, Navani's captured homeland made a secure staging base for the enemy, who fought the coalition forces led by Taravangian and Dalinar. Fighting on this front had mostly been skirmishes along the border. The Fused had so far refused to be caught in any traditional large-scale battles, and much of the border between Alethkar and Yakaved was difficult terrain, making it easy for roving bands on both sides to raid and then vanish. Dalinar felt that the coalition would soon need to make a large offensive. Navani agreed. The protracted nature of this war gave the advantage to the enemy. The coalition's radiant numbers were increasing slowly now, particularly with the Honor Spren withholding their support. However, the enemy singers, once untrained, were growing into better troops by the day, and more Fused were appearing. Dalinar wanted to push into Alethkar and seize the capital. The mink trailed through the illusory mountains along the Alethi border. So far, other than raids, Dalinar had focused on seizing control of the southwestern corner of Alethkar, the part that touched the Tarat Sea, to reinforce the coalition's naval superiority in the south. The close proximity of Yakaved and the Oathgate in Vaidenar allowed them to field troops here with quick resupply. It was the sole part of Alethkar they'd reclaimed so far, and it was a long, long way from the capital of Kolinar. Something had to be done. Each day their homeland remained in the enemy's hands was another day for the people there to be beaten down, controlled. Another day for the enemy to further entrench, feeding its armies on the sweat of Alethi farmers. It was a deep, unyielding kind of pain, thinking of Alethkar and knowing they were essentially a people in exile here in Urethiru. They'd lost their nation, and Dalinar, she knew, blamed himself. He thought if he'd been able to quash the squabbling high princes and finish the war at the Shattered Plains, Alethkar would not have fallen. "Yes," the mink said, squinting at the numbers of Alethi troops near the ocean in southern Alethkar, then glancing back at the Vaden armies manning the border. "Yes. Tell me, why do you show me this? This intelligence is precious. You trust me quickly." "We don't have much choice," Yasna said, causing him to turn toward her. "Have you followed the recent histories of Alethkar and Yakaved, General?"
"I've had my own troubles," he said. "But yes, civil war in both countries." "Ours was not a civil war," Dalinar said.
That was debatable. The rivalry with Sadeas, the contest on the Shattered Plains, the eventual turning of Amaram. "Regardless of what you term it," Yasna said, "the last few years have been painful for our two kingdoms. Yakaved lost practically its entire royal family and most of its best generals following the assassination of their king. We didn't fare much better. Our command staff has been gutted several times over."
"We are spread thin," Dalinar said. "Many of our best field generals are needed in Aesir. When I heard we had a chance to rescue the man who single-handedly held off the Singer invasion for a year."
Dalinar strode into the middle of the illusion, and it treated him differently, in subtle ways, from others. The color swirled near him, but the threads of stormlight reached out, connecting to him, like the arms of petitioners reaching toward their king.
"I want to know what you see,"
Dalinar said, sweeping his hand over the map.
"I want your analysis on what we're doing. I want your help. In exchange, we will use our forces to recover Herdaz. Help me retake Alethkar
and I will spare no effort in seeing your people freed.
Having the Blackthorn on my side would be novel, the mink said. Before I make any promises, though, tell me why you have so many troops stationed here, here, and here.
He pointed at several fortifications on the southern border of Alethkar, near the ocean.
We need to hold the ports, Dalinar said.
Yes. I assume that excuse works for the others in your coalition?
Dalinar drew his lips to a line, glancing at Jasnah. Behind her, Wit raised both eyebrows and leaned against the far wall. He was uncharacteristically quiet in meetings, but one could read entire strings of mockery in his expressions.
The enemy concentrations are here, across the river, the mink said, pointing. If you were truly concerned only with them, you'd fortify directly opposite to prevent a strike when the river runs dry between storms. You don't. Curious. Of course you'd be exposed from behind. It's almost like you don't trust the one watching your back.
The much shorter man met Dalinar's gaze and left the words hanging in the air. Wit coughed into his hand.
I believe Taravangian is working for the enemy, Dalinar said with a sigh. 1 year ago, someone let enemy troops in to attack Yirithiru, and despite excuses and deflections that have convinced the others, I am certain Taravangian's Radiant was the one who did it.
Dangerous, the mink said. Fighting in a war where your strongest ally is also your greatest fear? And Radiance? Serving the other side? How could this be?
They wouldn't be the only ones, unfortunately, Jasnah said. We've lost one entire order, the Skybreakers, to the enemy, and they have been harrying Aesir, requiring us to keep dedicating forces in that region. The Dustbringers continue to flirt with rebellion, often ignoring Dalinar's orders.
Troubling, the mink said.
He walked up along the border of Alethkar, passing Jasnah.
You amass here as well. You want to push into your homeland, don't you? You seek to recapture Kolinar.
Delaying will lose us the war, Navani said. The enemy grows in strength each day.
I agree with this assessment, the mink said. But attacking Alethkar?
We want to make a large, powerful offensive, Dalinar explained. We are trying to persuade the other monarchs to see how vital it is.
Ah, the mink said. Yes. And an outside general, approaching this fresh, would be persuasive to them, wouldn't he?
That's the hope, Dalinar said.
Yet you couldn't help trying to predispose me, eh? The mink said. You wanted to show this to me early. Get me on your side first, not risk any surprises.
We've had enough surprises dropped on us in meetings of the monarchs, Navani said.
I suppose I can't blame you, the mink said.
Nope, no blame.
But a question remains. What do you want from me, you Colins? Would you prefer a reinforcement of what you already want to believe? Or do you seek the truth?
I always want the truth, Dalinar said. And if you know anything of my niece, you'll know she has no qualms stating the truth as she sees it, regardless of the consequences.
Yes, the mink said, looking at Jasnah. I know of your reputation, Your Majesty. As for the Blackthorn, I would not have believed you 2 years ago.
The mink lifted his finger.
Then my niece read to me your book. The whole thing, yes. We got a copy, which was difficult, and I listened with much interest. I do not trust the Blackthorn, but perhaps I can trust the man who would write the words you did.
He studied Dalinar, as if weighing him. Then the mink turned and strode across the map.
I can perhaps help you escape this mess. You must not attack Alethkar.
But, Dalinar began,
I agree you need to make an offensive,
the Mink said. However, if Teravengian is not trustworthy, an expedition into Alethkar now would expose your forces to catastrophe. Even without the danger of betrayal, the enemy is too strong in the area. I've spent time fighting them. I can tell you that their footing is sure in your country. We won't push them out easily, and we certainly can't do it while prosecuting a two-front war.
The Mink stopped in Aesir, then pointed toward the fighting in Emul.
Here, you have the enemy pinned between you and a rival force. They're using those skybreakers to distract you from how exposed they are here. Your enemy is landlocked, with serious supply troubles, isolated from its allies in Eri and Alethkar. You want a big offensive that has a chance to work? Reclaim Emul. Push the Voidbringers, the Singers, out of Makabak. You need to consolidate. Focus on where the enemy is weakest. You do not need to smash your armies into the most fortified enemy position in a reckless attempt to satisfy your wounded Alethi pride. That is the truth.
Navani looked at Dalinar, hating the way the words made him deflate, his shoulders slouching. He wanted so badly to free his homeland. She was not the tactical genius Dalinar was. She would not have objected if he'd insisted that freeing Alethkar was the correct move. But the way he turned, bowing his head as the Mink spoke, told her he knew the Mink was right. Perhaps Dalinar had known it already. Perhaps he'd needed to hear it from someone else. "Let us get you more detailed reports," Yasna said, "so you can see if the facts support your instincts, Mink."
"Yes, that would be wise," the Mink said. "Many a locked room reveals a hidden path to escape, after all."
"Adolin, if you would, please," Yasna asked. "Yes, and you, Shallan. See our guest to the military briefing chambers and give him access to our scribes and any maps from our archive vault. Teshev should be able to provide exact numbers and recent battle data. Study with care, Mink. We meet with the monarchs in a few weeks' time to discuss our next big offensive, and I would have a plan ready." The Mink bowed to her and retreated with Adolin and Shallan. As soon as he was gone, the map collapsing as Shallan left, Yasna changed subtly. Her face became less of a mask. She didn't walk with a queenly gait as she strode over and settled down at the room's small table. This was the woman taking off her crown, now that she was with only family. Family and wit, Navani thought, as the lanky man, dressed all in black, walked over to fetch some wine. She couldn't tell if the rumors about those two were true or not, and hadn't felt comfortable asking. Strange that a mother should feel so unwilling to chat with her daughter about intimate matters. But, well, that was Yasna.
"I was worried about this," Dalinar said, taking a seat opposite Yasna at the table. "I need to persuade him that the battle must push toward Alethkar."
"Uncle," Yasna said, "are you going to be stubborn about this?"
"Maybe," he said.
"He saw it almost immediately," Yasna said. "Teravangian must know we don't trust him. We can't strike into Alethkar right now. It hurts me as much as it does you, but..."
"I know,"
Dalinar said, as Navani sat next to him and put her hand on his shoulder.
"But I have this terrible feeling, Yasna. It whispers that there is no way to win this war. Not against an immortal enemy. I worry about losing, but I worry more about something else. What do we do if we force them out of Aesir, and they agree to cease hostilities? Would we give up Alethkar if it meant ending the war?"
"I don't know," Yasna said. "That seems to be putting our chulls to work before we've bought them. We don't know if such a compromise as you suggest is possible."
"It wouldn't be,"
Wit said. Navani frowned, glancing toward the man who sipped his wine. He walked over and absently handed Jasnah a cup, his beak of a nose hidden in his own cup as he tipped it back.
Wit, Dalinar asked, is this one of your jokes?
Odium is a punchline, Dalinar, but not to any joke you've been told.
Wit sat with them at the table, not asking permission. He always acted as if dining with kings and queens was his natural state.
Odium will not compromise. He will not settle for anything other than our complete submission. Perhaps destruction.
Dalinar frowned, then glanced to Navani. She shrugged. Wit often spoke like that, as if he knew things he shouldn't. They couldn't tell whether he was pretending or serious, but pressing him usually merely got you ridiculed. Dalinar wisely remained silent, contemplating the offered tidbit.
A strong offensive in Emul, Jasnah said thoughtfully. There might be a gem heart at the center of this monster, Dalinar. A stable Makabak would strengthen our coalition. A clear, powerful victory would raise morale and energize our allies.
A valid point,
Dalinar said with a grunt. There is more, Jasnah said. A reason to want Aesir and the surrounding countries secured in the months moving forward.
What more? Dalinar asked. What are you talking about?
Jasnah looked to Wit, who nodded, rising. I'll fetch them. Don't belittle anyone while I'm gone, Brightness. You'll make me feel obsolete. He slipped out the door.
He will bring the heralds, Jasnah said. Until he returns, perhaps we can discuss the proposal I showed you before you left for Hearthstone, Uncle.
Oh dear, Navani thought. Here we go. Jasnah had been pushing toward a singular law for Alethkar. A dangerous one. Dalinar stood up and began to pace, not a good sign.
This isn't the time, Jasnah. We can't create social upheaval on this scale during such a terrible moment in our history.
Says the man, Jasnah said, who wrote a book earlier this year, upending centuries of established gender norms. Dalinar winced.
Mother, Jasnah said to Navani. I thought you said you'd talk to him.
There wasn't a convenient opportunity, Navani said. And, to be honest, I share his concerns.
I forbid this, Dalinar said. You can't simply free every Alethi slave. It would cause mass chaos.
I wasn't aware, Jasnah said, that you could forbid the queen from taking action.
You called it a proposal, Dalinar said.
Because I am not finished with the wording yet, Jasnah replied. I intend to propose it to the High Princes soon and gauge their reactions. I will deal with their concerns as best I can before I make it law. Whether or not I will make it law, however, is not a matter I intend to debate.
Dalinar continued to pace.
I cannot see reason in this, Jasnah. The chaos this will cause.
Our lives are already in chaos, Jasnah said. This is precisely the time to make sweeping changes, when people are already adjusting to a new way of life. The historical data supports this idea.
But why? Dalinar asked. You're always so pragmatic. This seems the opposite.
I seek the line of action that does the most possible good for the most people. This is in keeping with my moral philosophy.
Dalinar stopped pacing and rubbed his forehead instead. He looked to Navani as if to say, can you do anything?
What did you think would happen? Navani asked, putting her on the throne.
I thought she'd keep the Light Eyes in check, he said, and figured she wouldn't be bullied by their schemes.
That is exactly what I'm doing, Jasnah said. Though I apologize for needing to count you in the group, Uncle.
It is good for you to oppose me. Feel free to do so visibly. Too many saw Elokar bending knee to you, and that nasty business with a High King still lingers as a distasteful scent. By showing we are not united in this, we strengthen my position, proving I am no pawn of the Blackthorn.
I wish you'd slow down, Dalinar said. I'm not completely opposed to the theory of what you're doing. It shows compassion, but...
If we slow down, Yasna said, the past catches up to us. History is like that, always gobbling up the present. She smiled fondly at Dalinar.
I respect and admire your strength, uncle. I always have. Once in a while, though, I do think you need to be reminded that not everyone sees the world the way you do.
It would be better for us all if they did, he grumbled. I wish the world would stop making a mess of itself every time I turn the other direction.
He got something to drink from the pitcher of wine. Orange, naturally.
Would this include the Ardents, daughter? Navani asked. They're slaves,